Hi, I'm Karen Webster, and welcome to Data Drivers, our weekly show where we tell the story of something in payments using only three data points. Today, I'm joined by Currency Cloud CEO, Mike Lavin. Mike, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Karen.
And joining from London, so we'll get into a whole mix of conversation today about a variety of topics. And let's start it off by getting some insight from a study that you did talking to 70 executives across 37 countries about the state of payments, both B2C payments and B2B payments, and that's where I'd like to start. So data point number one, according to your study, 55% of those you spoke with believe that the best potential, the greatest potential in payments as measured by profit potential is in the B2B sector. Why?
So first, let me just make a quick comment about the study. This is the third year that we've sponsored with a few other firms a survey of leaders in the payments world, sort of to take the temperature and to figure out, to get what a set of issues are. So we do it as a global, and then we present it. This year we presented it at Money 2020 in Copenhagen, and we'll again do the study again next year. So the B2B is very different. If you look at the consumer market, the consumer-to-consumer or the peer-to-peer market, there are a lot of independent companies. In the previous generation, of course, there was Western Union, there was Zoom, TransferWise, Remitly, in Europe is Azimo, or Zimo, as we would call it in the U.S. So there's a whole series of companies that are in the consumer space. The B2B space is different because business payments are different. And let me talk a little bit about why business payments are different, and they're harder. So there are actually fewer independent companies that are trying to go after them because it's much more of a technical challenge. So if you look at business payments, there's a lot of data associated with the business payment. Again, in a consumer payment, you know who you're paying, you have a little information about their bank account, you know where it's going. But a business payment may be tied to payroll, it may be tied to a receivable, it may be tied to a loan, it may be tied to a lot of things, so there's a lot of data that has to go to it. Again, in a consumer payment, it's usually fairly discreet. I send my mother $100 or I remit my salary of $1,000 and it goes to one place. Businesses may do a payment run once a month, or they may do one transfer from which there's 1,000 payments, so one to many. They may do 1,000 payments which are consolidated to one place, so many to one, or they may do it many to many. So inside the business world, there's a lot of complexity that requires a lot more technology to be able to service. So I think the reason that we look at, or the jury finds, that there's more room for profitability is because ultimately there's going to be one, huge flows, a large technical component, and a different set of values for business than just the pure money transfer, so that the business services component, pretty much dominated by banks, fewer independent companies, real need on the part of businesses, and so a lot of room to provide value to the customer.
So Mike, let me ask a different question about profits. So, you know, in talking to VCs about investing in the B2B space, you know, it's a bit of a double edge. There's massive opportunity, but it's also a longer time to profit because businesses are very hard to change. How do you respond to that?
Well, so I've been involved personally in consumer payment issues and in enterprise sales. So the kinds of things that we do are effectively going to be used by enterprises. They probably are be using banks right now. So that in that sense, some of the more viral pieces that you would get in a peer-to-peer play aren't there. On the other hand, it's extremely sticky. By that I mean, in the consumer world, people flock to the best price because it's often only just about price. Whereas in the business world, there's a whole series of value. Of course, you have to be cheap and you have to be fast. But those things are a given. But there's a whole series of values beyond just fast and cheap in terms of the kinds of things I talked about before, in terms of one-to-many, many-to-one, platform issues, a lot of compliance that you have to provide for your customer, and a lot of integration to data. So on the one hand, it may go slower, but your customer retention is much higher, of course, as long as you're providing the service. So it's a trade-off. It's not a consumer, it's very different than dealing in the consumer market. On the other hand, your relationships with your customers tend to be much more long-term, and in that sense, I guess you could look at that as being ultimately more profitable as you have a much longer relationship with individual customers.
In both instances, scale is critical. But I think in terms of the whole procurement process, if you will, more decision makers, more inertia, frankly, depending upon the nature of the B2B environment that you have to overcome, and often the larger the organization, the tougher that is. But I agree with you. I think there's massive potential for all the reasons that I just said. There's a lot of inertia and a lot of old systems that need to change.
Well, remember the way that the world of SaaS metrics looks at it is what's the cost of acquiring a customer, and what's the value of that customer over the long term. In a consumer, the cost of acquiring that customer has to be in the tens of dollars, and the value of that customer to the business is in the hundreds of dollars or thousands. Mm-hmm. Whereas we're in the world of enterprise sales, so that actually the amount of money that we spend working with a customer and acquiring a customer is much higher, but then the amount of money that that customer will spend with us is also much higher. So it's just a different set of metrics that you apply to a very, very similar kind of problem, but it's a different way to think.
What is the impact of APIs on getting businesses to the table to consider new and innovative ways to change their business processes?
So if we take a step back, when we're talking about APIs, what we're really talking about is the integration, in our case, of cross-currency payments into some fundamental business process inside the firm. So if you don't do that integration through an API, you're probably going to click through, you can have a badge on something, and you'll get your payment done. Things will be mm-hmm. fine. But you may come out of one environment and go into another. You'll have problems with data reconciliation. To go back to where I said before on the B2B world, data is really important. There's always data associated with a payment, and that data could be coming out of a procurement system, payables, receivables, trade finance. It can be coming out of all sorts of places. What you want is the payment to be matched with the data, and the best way to do that is integrating your app, whatever that app happens to be, and at Currency Cloud would be indifferent to that, into the payment module. I think one thing is really interesting about us, that for the volume of payments we do per month, there's actually 2x that volume of transactions being transacted in our sandbox. Hmm. So we do a couple of 100,000 payments every month right now, 250 to 300. Double that number are people, developers, playing around in the sandbox, developing apps, and we don't know exactly what they're doing, but eventually they show up and want to go forward and using the product. So there's the API basically makes that kind of data integration available for apps into the company.
Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to get your thoughts on any differences that the executives may have expressed on the potential for B2B versus B2C, just based on where they are in the world and how developed their own consumer and business marketplaces are.
So we have a lot of personal experience with this and what people had to say. as well. So remember, the U.S. is the world's largest economy, and the international component of that economy for any individual country is the largest, but as a percentage of GDP, it's actually quite small. It's actually smaller than a lot of European countries. So what you find in North America is a tremendous amount of cross-border business, but highly dispersed. In Europe, any individual countries will be tremendous more experience, going back to the pre-Euro days, of everyone having to deal in cross-border payments. So the basic knowledge in small to medium firms of how to deal economically in the cross-border world is far greater in Europe than it is in the U.S. In the U.S., our cross-border world is very much dominated by banks. When we talk to people how the payments are being made now, it's being made by banks. Now, listen, and there's a series of firms, you know, not only ourselves, of course, who are addressing that in the U.S., but it's still very much a banking-dominated world. In Europe, it's slightly less so. When we get to Asia, and I think the big issue that we're talking about, the big money movement that we're talking about these days is money moving from e-tailers, mostly Chinese who sell on Amazon or Walmart or Wish, and moving their funds back to Asia, and then money moving out of China, moving into the West. Again, there's a lot of expertise because people have had to move the funds back and forth.
Interesting. So let me move to the second data point, which I have to say I found surprising, but I'm curious to get your thoughts on it. So 64% of those you surveyed believe that Asia is the clear leader in payments innovation. Did that surprise you?
Yep. Let me talk about that. On a personal basis, I guess if you've ever been to a restaurant in China, where you walk in and you scan a QR code with the menu and you get the menu, you order and eat off of your phone and it's automatically paid for, you know you're somewhere where things have gone way beyond what we're doing in the West. If you look at the kinds of things that, in terms of how much payments are done in WeChat, where in the WhatsApp world, we're not making payments. We're not making payments at that extent out of Facebook or Messenger. So on the consumer side, for anything that we think we're really advanced in, if you look at some of the things that are going on in China, they'll have a billion users doing something that we proudly think that we're working on. So the degree to which people are using smartphones to do every single kind of conceivable consumer innovation, payment innovation, is really incredible. And remember, one of the things that happens in the business world is innovation often starts with consumers. Consumers have their smartphone, they have their mobile, they use it to transact. The same person goes to work and they think, well, you know, why am I struggling at work when this stuff has become so easy on the consumer side? So innovations at the consumer level always find their way into the business environment. If you look at what Tencent does, Ant, Alipay, these are huge, you know, online payment businesses addressing the kinds of problems that we talk about in the fintech world, but already with billions of users. So when we talk about 64% agree that Asia is the clear leader, it really refers to that, and you just have to make a trip to Beijing or to Shanghai or to Guangzhou or any of those other cities and see the level of sort of ground floor innovation in the world of moving everything cashless, everything online, to know whether 64% or 90% that the innovation is really coming out of Asia, and particularly China.
So I would agree that there's a tremendous amount of innovation, and it really is it is amazing to see the progress of, you know, WeChat Pay, Alipay. It really is remarkable. But their starting point was very different. And, you know, the U.S. isn't necessarily a bunch of Luddites, but we're trying to move away from, you know, an infrastructure that was built to accommodate a different kind of relationship between consumers and merchants, and now we're evolving that. So it's true, but it's also perhaps not an entirely fair comparison.
Yeah, more or less, but in the U.S., the infrastructure also progresses slowly. I mean, for example, I think personally in London, I don't think I've written more than one check in the last 5 years. Last year, about 5 or 7 years ago, when the London Tube went contactless, mm-hmm. so that you could use your credit card to go to the tube, it mm-hmm. really spearheaded contactless payments throughout the whole country. Mm-hmm. So that when you look at the U.S., if I try to use contactless for everything I do, the amount of checks that I have to write still to make things work, the difficulty in doing or the cost of doing wire transfers. And listen, there are a lot of companies that are addressing all of this, but there's a lot of infrastructure pieces that, having started from a different place, move faster. But listen, Venmo is an incredible innovation. And I don't know the user numbers of Venmo, but if you talk to anybody, well, it used to be under 25, now they've got older, so they're under 30, and now they've got older again, so they're probably under 35. It's not that the U.S. is without innovation, but starting from a place where you don't have some old infrastructure that represents a different relationship from the individual to the banking system, you can go a lot faster, and that's the sense that you can do.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. What is the view that you have in your survey participants in the role of regulation in stimulating innovation? Is it a help or a hindrance?
Do we have another podcast?
We probably might need another 30 minutes to talk about that, but just briefly.
In the course of this year, we have to implement wire transfer regulation 2, WTR 2, the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, the Money Laundering Directive 4, Payment Services Directive 2, and MiFID, who I can't remember exactly what it means. So the when you talk
I'm laughing with you, Mike, not at you.
So there's a massive amount of regulation, but I think what you have to get your mind around for a medium-sized company and, of course, a large business as well, is it's not like you have an option. It's not like you could say, oh, that sounds interesting. I know it'll be of value to society, but I can't do it. So I don't look at regulation as a hindrance to innovation anymore. I look at it as one of those necessary pieces of the world that are not going to go away, that you just have to accept as a given. And then having done that, you then have to apply creativity to it to understand what the requirement is, how you meet that requirement. In our case, of course, helping to bring our customers along with it. The debate, of course, is you can look from a startup world and say, this is all getting in my way, if only. You know, if only I didn't have to do this, then, well, I could do that. Well, it's not worth it thinking like that. The regulators themselves are actually not getting any easier. Every time we hear about a hacking scandal, whether it's Equifax today or somebody else, whether it's related to us or not, or a data security breach or something like that, all of that means that the degree of data protection, the degree of price disclosure, the degree of requiring openness, that's not going to get less. So at least the attitude that I think you have to have is the degree of regulation sort of fixes this playing field, and then actually you have to be able to innovate on top of that, and you don't have any choice. That's the only thing you can do.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. I mean, I do wonder, though, if there comes a point in time where there is so much regulation that just the cost of compliance makes innovation really challenging, especially for smaller firms that, you know, have to bake that into the cost of doing business and simply don't have the margins or necessarily the investors willing to fund their bank accounts just to comply with rules.
So I think what you get is a different structure to the market. Remember, the reason that one is regulated is because you touch the money.
Right.
If you're a technology firm that is purely a technology vendor and you actually don't have the funds flowing through you, then you have a very different regulatory position. So I think that you start to get in a structure where you have technology firms who then provide services to a smaller number of regulated firms so that you can get tremendous technical innovation and a limited number of firms who actually touch the funds.
Mm-hmm.
That, on the one hand, you can look at regulation as a barrier to entry because it means that it stops small firms from going forward. On the other hand, in Europe, we're starting to see a series of sort of intermediate technology firms who have technology platforms that will provide compliance, they will provide payment processing, they'll provide bank access, they'll provide compliance, a whole series of things, but they actually won't handle the money, so they won't have to be regulated, but they'll provide those services to regulated entities. So I think it ends up with a very different market structure.
So that sort of segues nicely into the third point, which is that global fintechs are raking in a lot of money, $36 billion in 2016 alone. Payments companies got not quite half, but not far from it, 40% of total funds. Does that support some of what you're talking about, which is trying to understand this balance between providing services to regulated companies and creating the innovative pipeline of services and APIs that help everybody win?
Yeah, so a lot has been written about the transformation of the banking environment banking is being one of the last vertically integrated industries where banks provide a whole series of services and you take them or leave them, and then those services themselves being disaggregated so that, you know, I'm going to provide cross-border, someone else will provide loans, someone else will do something in the auto loan business, so that next step in innovation, which is often related to using big data and using APIs and ability to access accounts, means that going from a financial environment of 25 years ago that the only thing you could do was start a bank now means there's a lot of different things that you can do in terms of wealth management, in terms of asset management, in terms of the technology that enables those, in terms of the kinds of startups that will work on those kinds of pieces, so that suddenly you have a belief that this banking environment will transform. And again, there's lots been written about, you know, millennials and let's just say that the progress that consumers have made in putting themselves online and that moving into the business environment, what that translates to is to lots of opportunity along the financial value chain where services will not be delivered in terms of either a monopoly or a monolithic kind of way. So the venture world is making lots of little bets, and maybe not so little, but making a tremendous amount of bets in if you think of it, the breakup of AT&T or the breakup of the oil companies, the breakup of the banks. But if you remember, AT&T and the oil companies didn't go away. They're still there, and the banks will still be there as well. But the services that they're providing will not be monolithic. There'll be a lot of other players. Some will be regulated, providing a financial service. Some will be technology providers, providing it to banks or to other regulated companies. But the amount of opportunity just mushrooms dramatically. It continues to mushroom as that banking environment becomes more open. Thus, you see all the money coming in lots of different places and lots of different ways.
So your position is that the future of banking is going to look very different because ecosystems will be kind of taken apart and put back together in perhaps different pieces?
Yeah, I mean, listen, the banks as a secure repository of funds, that may stay. And also, remember, one of the basic banking function of taking in deposits and then using the deposits to lend out and making money on the margin, that business stays there. But everything around that, in terms of running the current account, in terms of analyzing your expenses, in terms of advising you on investment, in terms of loans, all of those things around that actually can move to fintech firms. And there'll be some new banks as well that start from a purely digital perspective, a branchless digital perspective. But yeah, I think that you'll see banks still continuing to be a repository, having the funds, having your personal information, but then a whole series of services going around that ecosystem, taking pieces away from that. The larger banks, just like other larger entities that had large monolithic or monopoly positions, they're not going away. They're going to be there, and they're going to be providing an essential service to a tremendous number of people. But there's going to be a lot of other players with lots of other pieces in there.
Do you think that there's a chance that the 14,000 banks we have in the U.S. might shrink to some other manageable number?
Oh God, who knows? You know, I know when I walk around, though I'm in London, I am an American. When I walk around small towns in the U.S., they still have their own local bank, which still has what we would call in the U.K. a bank manager, making local loans, servicing those loans, and having a personal connection. So on the one hand, you would think that that number will consolidate, but it hasn't consolidated that dramatically yet. You would think that the neighborhood bank would go the way of the neighborhood pharmacy, which has become Rite Aid or Walmart or CVS, and you would think that that would occur. But like everything else in banking, that happens really slowly.
Yep. As the customers disappear, one way or the other, we won't talk about how that happens. Final comment, I can't let you go without getting a perspective from London on Brexit. How is it on the ground in London? Is it as dramatic as we're reading about it here in the U.S.? How are you preparing?
So the journalist questions have shifted in the course of this year from whether my opinion is this is a good thing or a bad thing to what am I doing about it. So from the perspective of small and medium companies or even large companies, this is now a fact of life. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. That means for companies like ourselves who have been regulated in the UK and thus have the whole of the European market open to us, at some point we believe that we will have to be re-regulated in one European market. But remember, in the U.S., we have to be regulated in 50 states. Having to be regulated by another authority who has a different set of rules or even a similar set of rules is like nothing new to us. I guess all that one can say is it's a cost that we probably didn't need to bear. It's a diversion of attention, which we probably didn't want to do, but it's a fact that we have to deal with. The major issue that one cares about, I think, because we'll just have to get through that, and where there's the most unknown has to do with talent. Just like in Silicon Valley, where you have to recruit people from all over the world or Route 128, you recruit the best people for what you can do from all over the world. We do the same thing in London, and we have the advantage of an employee sort of catchment area that encompasses all of Europe. And the Currency Cloud, like many other fintech firms in London, has 20-25% of our employees come from outside the UK. Right now, those people are fairly stable. They feel comfortable being in the UK because of their high expertise. But the greatest threat is not the regulatory threat. We'll figure that out. We have to. The greatest threat is the access to talent and the talent that we have feeling comfortable. And that's still a touch-and-go situation.
Interesting. Well, Mike, it was great to catch up with you today. Thanks for all your great insights on a variety of issues that are all very important to payments players the world over. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye. Thank you.